Welcome back to ETG Case Reports Journal's Behind the Case podcast. I'm Maya Mahmoud, second year GI fellow at St. Louis University. My guest today is Jill Elwing, associate professor of medicine at Washington University, who practices at the VA with expertise in inflammatory bowel disease. We'll be discussing this article entitled Use of Janus Kinase Inhibitor Upadacitinib in Microscopic Colitis, published in the February 2026 issue of ACG Case Reports Journal. Dr. Elwing, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to do this podcast with you.
Thank you. Before we get to the case, let's set the foundation. What exactly is microscopic colitis?
All right. Well, microscopic colitis is a chronic inflammatory condition of the colon. It's very common. It's a cause of watery, non-bloody diarrhea in older people. The defining feature is that the colon looks normal, i.e. microscopic. The diagnosis lives under the microscope. There are two major subtypes, lymphocytic and collagenous. It's not rare. It accounts for about 13% of chronic diarrhea cases. 11 per 100,000 person years is the incidence. And the diagnostic yield increases when you select the population that typically has this. So older people and more common in females. The pathophysiology isn't completely understood, but it's similar to other inflammatory conditions. It's usually a trigger that then sets off an inflammatory cascade in someone who has the right genes.
How does microscopic colitis typically present?
Well, interestingly, you know, it's an acute onset watery diarrhea. So a lot of times patients will even tell you they can almost remember the date that it started, which is a little different than other diseases. But it's watery diarrhea. It keeps the company of nocturnal stools in about half the patients, some urgency, incontinence, abdominal pain, modest weight loss, and think about sometimes even more systemic fatigue, arthralgias. And the people you're looking for are older, 60 to 65, and females have a 9-to-1 predominance of this disease. There's also other autoimmune diseases that tag along, like thyroid disease and celiac disease, and certain medications are classic. So if someone starts on a new medication, a PPI, an NSAID, an SSRI, a statin, that may also be another clue to the diagnosis. If a patient has significant weight loss, though, you better think about other things, like maybe they have celiac, which goes along with microscopic colitis.
This is where it gets tricky in practice, because so many of the patients carry a prior label of IBS diarrhea. Dr. Elwing, how do you distinguish the two?
You know, I think the timing of the onset, the demographics, but also the overlap of more alert or alarm symptoms, like weight loss, nocturnal diarrhea, really should clue you in that something else is going on. And, you know, just blood testing isn't going to be enough or stool testing isn't going to be enough. You're going to have to think about a colonoscopy with biopsies to actually make the diagnosis.
From a practical standpoint, when you actually take that patient to colonoscopy, what does microscopic colitis look like endoscopically?
Well, that's the interesting thing. It's microscopic. So you go in and things look normal and you really have to do the biopsies. Sometimes you can see changes like patchy edema, erythema. And I have seen this on occasion. People with collagenous colitis will actually have these mucosal tears. They call them cat scratch lesions, or sometimes we call it barotrauma. That might be a clue, but it's not going to replace the biopsies.
You touched on something I wanted to explore a little further. Where should the endoscopist be sampling?
Okay, well, there's actually some good data on this. There was a 2020 study by Vereen. They looked at over 100 patients, and they saw that certain areas of the colon were going to be more common to show microscopic colitis. So they looked at ascending and descending colon biopsies as being, if you get both of those and you put them in separate jars, you're going to have a very high yield to make a diagnosis. Don't rely on rectosigmoid biopsies alone. It's just not sensitive enough.
So once those biopsies confirm the diagnosis, the real challenge begins, because making the diagnosis and successfully treating it are two very different things. And that's what makes this case worth walking through, because even the diagnosis here was not as clear as it first looked. The authors here, Mum and Stein, described a 64-year-old woman with a history of eczema who presented with chronic watery diarrhea and was diagnosed with collagenous type microscopic colitis in 2016. She started budesonide 9 milligrams daily, which significantly improved her diarrhea, but she gained more than 40 pounds and ended up tapering off. Here's the part I wanted to focus on. Even at that first diagnosis in 2016, there was a clue that something else was going on. Her tissue transglutaminase, IgA, levels was elevated, but her celiac biopsies at that time were negative. So she was labeled as microscopic colitis alone. Fast forward to 2020, she re-established care with persistent symptoms. The infectious workup was negative, and a repeat colonoscopy after a course of budesonide actually showed no evidence of microscopic colitis. But this time, the workup revealed findings consistent with celiac disease, now confirmed by celiac-specific antibodies. So, this is a patient who tested negative for celiac initially and was only diagnosed years later. Dr. Elwing, how common is the overlap microscopic colitis celiac disease? And when you finally do uncover concurrent celiac disease, how does that change the way you manage the colitis?
Yeah, the overlap it's real and it's clinically important. You can see that patients, you know, are going to have the potential of having ongoing symptoms and probably more weight loss. About 30 to 50% of patients with microscopic colitis have coexisting autoimmune disease. So celiac disease is one of those classic associations. Although only a minority of the microscopic colitis patients will have celiac, there is a shared genetic link. It's the HLA-DQ2-DQ8 genetics. And that points you to be able to think about celiac as part of the pathogenesis of this disease. Negative celiac evaluation doesn't exclude celiac forever. So you can see in this patient, she initially had a questionable diagnosis and then a firm diagnosis. So someone that you have that has microscopic colitis, you really need to, before you start escalating therapy, you really need to think about retesting for celiac because it complicates the management significantly if you're treating the wrong condition.
And I think that's a really important practical point. Before escalating therapy in a patient with microscopic colitis and concurrent celiac disease, you really need to confirm that celiac component is being adequately managed. In this case, the patient reported adherence to a gluten-free diet, but the endoscopic and serologic findings suggested ongoing gluten exposure. Despite additional dietary counseling and strict gluten-free diet, this patient continued to have severe symptoms over the following years. She cycled through repeated courses of budesonide, bile acid sequestrants, loperamide, bismuth subsalicylate, and mesalamine, all with only temporary or minimal relief. Every attempt to reduce budesonide below 9 milligrams was followed by worsening diarrhea. And importantly, she was developing significant adverse effects from high-dose steroids, not just the weight gain, but also cataracts, which ultimately led her to stop budesonide entirely. She was then tried on the vedolizumab in late 2020. She initially had mild improvement after 3 infusions, but ultimately failed to maintain symptom control. Dr. Elwing, when you have a budesonide-dependent patient with intolerable steroid side effects who has now failed vedolizumab, what's your thought process and when do you reach for different advanced therapies?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think, again, you have to go back and confirm that you're dealing with a diagnosis of microscopic colitis. Make sure that the celiac is genuinely being managed. Make sure that you're not dealing with some other secondary cause of diarrhea, like just an infection or some other source. When the budesonide fails or can't be tolerated, we start to be thinking about these other advanced therapies, biologics and small molecules. You know, oftentimes in someone like this, you might involve like an IBD expert, maybe at one of the university hospitals that has more expertise in advanced therapies. Historically, anti-TNFs have been the next medication to go to. And now, like this case, used vedolizumab, which is also a good choice because a lot of times these patients are older with comorbidities. And that makes veto a great choice because they're gut selective and have a really good safety profile. So once she lost response to veto, though, we were really genuinely on thin territory, trying to figure out what would be the next agent. And so JAK inhibitors, although remaining investigational, there is some data that these medications are effective in microscopic colitis. So it was a reasonable and interesting next thought.
Well, that actually leads nicely to the management here. So in this case, the decision was made to initiate a JAK inhibitor. The patient was started on upadacitinib at 45 milligrams once daily for 12 weeks. Then this dose was reduced to 30 milligrams daily. The response was described as rapid and significant. Her bowel movements decreased to fewer than 3 per day. But what I found particularly interesting about this case is that the patient's lifelong treatment-resistant eczema has also resolved. The patient wrote to the clinic, and I'm quoting from the paper, "I am pooping like a normal person again, and my eczema is fading." So, Dr. Elwing, what, in your view, makes this case compelling rather than just anecdotal?
Yeah, I think there's a few features that really raise this above a simple anecdote. First, it's the depth of prior failure. Cycled through budesonide, multiple antidiarrheals, bile acid sequestrants, mesalamine, veto. So all of the conventional or even non-conventional therapies were just either working for short periods of time or not working. Second, the magnitude and speed for which she had improvement, going from more than 10 stools to quickly to 2 to 3. And then the durable and de-escalating medication doses that still resulted in remission of her disease. Finally, I think we can understand, we know that the microscopic colitis is associated with other autoimmune diseases. And I think it speaks to the fact that this medication is working not only in your colon, but systemically, as not only did her GI symptoms improve, but her eczema had a significant response. And that shared inflammatory mechanism gives us even a better sense that we're targeting the right cytokines, the right inflammatory pathway. Although this is a single case, I think the features of this case make it a strong signal rather than just an anecdote.
So as you mentioned, there's also an interesting dosing story here. At a follow-up visit in early 2025, the patient reported sustained resolution of diarrhea, but was experiencing weight gain and acne on the 30 milligrams dose. The dose was then reduced to 50 milligrams daily. In late 2025, she reported continued remission with fewer side effects. So this patient went from 45 milligram induction to 30, then to 15 milligrams, which is the lowest approved maintenance dose in ulcerative colitis, and maintained her response at each step down. Does that trajectory influence how you'd approach dosing in microscopic colitis? Does it suggest that lower, safer maintenance doses might be sufficient?
Yes, I think this fits kind of our broader IBD or even other autoimmune disease principles of how we usually strategize biologics and small molecules. We think about induction and maintenance. And you know, the best thing about the JAK inhibitors, they work fast. And so you actually saw that in this patient. She got better quickly. And, you know, we were able to reduce the dose and maintain a durable remission. If a JAK inhibitor works in microscopic colitis, the ability to de-escalate to a lower maintenance dose should be considered because the risk-benefit balance is going to favor benefit and less risk in this older population. That being said, we can't derive a single dosing protocol from this one patient, but it is a rationale to try de-escalation strategies.
That's very helpful. Now, this isn't the first report of JAK inhibitors in microscopic colitis, and the authors discussed two previously published cases that are worth highlighting. The two earlier cases included a 75-year-old woman with collagenous colitis who failed budesonide, systemic steroids, cholestyramine, antidiarrheals, and multiple biologics, then achieved remission within a week of upadacitinib. And the other case was a 66-year-old man with long-standing lymphocytic colitis who experienced loss of response to budesonide and infliximab, lost access to vedolizumab, relapsed, was found to have celiac-associated villus atrophy despite negative serologies, and achieved complete clinical and histologic remission on the tofacitinib. So across these publications, we have three cases, two collagenous, one lymphocytic, all responding. Dr. Elwing, does that cross-subtype consistency increase your interest in the JAK-STAT as a target?
Yes, definitely. So both subtypes are meaningfully impacted by the JAK-dependent cytokine. They share a common downstream target. That makes sense. I would not claim one subtype responds better. I just don't think we have the data for that. But the cross-subtype consistency is what we would expect if the JAK-STAT is a true convergence point in this disease.
And from a mechanistic standpoint, is there real biologic plausibility here, or are we mainly extrapolating from conventional IBD?
I think it's rational. The mechanism is being repurposed rather than from blind extrapolation. Microscopic colitis predominantly affects TH1, TC1, TH17 mucosal cytokine profile with upregulation of interferon gamma, IL-12, 15, 17, 21, and 22, and several relevant pathways signal through JAK-STAT. Blocking the JAK-STAT, therefore, affects multiple inflammatory pathways all at once, which is broader than targeting a single ligand. The disease shares the HLA associations and inflammatory signatures associated with conventional IBD, so cross-disease reasoning is definitely defensible. The caveat is that microscopic colitis is not IBD, it's not Crohn's, it's not ulcerative colitis, and we don't understand the pathophysiology completely. And it certainly behaves differently in several different important ways. But I think it's reasonable to consider the JAK family as a potential durable treatment for these refractory microscopic colitis patients.
And that mechanistic rationale is exactly why these cases are worth taking seriously rather than dismissing. But biological plausibility cuts both ways. If we're going to reach for a JAK inhibitor in this population, we also have to be honest about the safety trade-offs because these drugs are not benign. Dr. Elwing, if you did decide to use a JAK inhibitor for refractory microscopic colitis, what would your pretreatment workup and ongoing monitoring look like?
This category certainly carries a risk, particular herpes zoster, as well as other thrombotic and cardiovascular risks. The concern traces largely to the oral surveillance trial with tofacitinib versus TNF-alpha inhibitors in rheumatoid arthritis. These patients were older and they had cardiovascular risks. Over a median of 4 years, the patients on tofa had higher rates of cardiovascular disease and cardiovascular events, 3.4 versus 2.5, as well as signals for venous thromboembolism, malignancy, and serious infections, particularly herpes zoster. However, this led to an FDA black box warning on this class of medications. Important nuances are that tofa is not upacitinib. It was rheumatoid arthritis, not microscopic colitis. And the ad hoc, post hoc analysis identified that typically the patients who had complications were 65 or older and were smoking and had other high risk features. In the IBD real world, we haven't seen this. It's been more reassuring. There are lower risk drugs, but we still can't eliminate the possibility that drugs attribute to the risk, particularly for these cardiovascular and infectious complications.
That's really helpful framing on safety. Building on that, does the risk-benefit calculation differ in microscopic colitis compared with your general IBD population?
Yeah, you know, I think we really have to think about this as two different populations when it comes to risk. The Crohn's and ulcerative colitis patients, they have more risk to their disease. They could undergo hospitalizations, surgeries, other things if we don't get their disease into remission. Yes, microscopic colitis carries with it more symptoms. So we have to really think about like what the underlying disease risk is, and then even if the patient is properly selected, we have to think about that their offset may be smaller. The typical microscopic colitis patient is older, may carry cardiovascular and malignancy risks that amplify that JAK safety signal. That doesn't always take JAK inhibitors off the table, but it does raise the bar for shared decision-making and argues for the lowest effective maintenance dose.
That's really helpful. Let's move from mechanism to the practical question. Suppose tomorrow you see a patient with biopsy-proven microscopic colitis who has persistent severe symptoms despite an adequate course of budesonide. Practically speaking, where would a JAK inhibitor fit in your algorithm today, and who might be an appropriate candidate?
So we're talking an off-label medication. So it's going to be something that's going to be later down the line in our options for genuinely refractory disease. My sequence would be to optimize budesonide, remove plausible triggers, confirm the disease and exclude the celiac as a contributing factor. Make sure that we're considering safer options, maybe the vedolizumab, like we did in this case. Depending on the patient, an anti-TNF agent would also be a reasonable option. I would generally reserve the JAK inhibitors for those who had failed all other clinically advisable medications. That would be based on my risk positioning with this off-label indication. The ideal candidate would have active disease, significant quality of life impairment, and failure or intolerance of safer options. they would have a low cardiovascular, thromboembolic, infectious, and malignancy risk. A coexisting JAK-responsive condition, such as the atopic dermatitis, would also strengthen the use, and that was helpful in this patient. Conversely, I wouldn't really want to use a JAK in someone who has cardiovascular disease and a current or significant previous smoking history.
That makes a lot of sense. So taking it one step further, if you did decide to proceed, what does your pretreatment evaluation and monitoring look like?
Okay, so JAK inhibitors, just like in IBD, we have to be thinking about safety. So in all medications that have certain safety profiles that increase the risk for infections and other significant comorbidities, we need to screen. We need to do a CBC, check liver and kidney function, check for latent tuberculosis, viral hepatitis B and C, assess HIV status. But something a little unique to the JAK inhibitors, we talked about this risk for major cardiac events. We need to check a lipid profile because there is data that the JAK inhibitors can increase your lipids, especially early on. So we'd want to do that at baseline and then recheck lipids in about 8 to 12 weeks and periodically after that, also monitoring the other blood tests. I also want to make sure that people understand that since this is being used in microscopic colitis, it doesn't change the increased risk for other infections. So make sure that all your patients have vaccinations up to date, including influenza, COVID, pneumococcal, but most importantly, before you start a JAK, make sure they're vaccinated for herpes zoster. Have them get the Shingrix vaccine before you start the medication. And I would favor starting with a induction dose, but then trying to get to the lowest effective maintenance dose possible.
That's very helpful. So to bring this all together, if a gastroenterologist is listening to us today and has a patient tomorrow with truly refractory microscopic colitis, what would you want their main three take-home messages to be?
Okay, first, confirm that it's truly active microscopic colitis before calling it refractory, especially when the original biopsy is remote or the patient has another condition like celiac. Re-biopsy when clinically appropriate. Rigorously evaluate for other causes of diarrhea. Second, JAK inhibition is a genuinely promising and mechanistically plausible option, but it remains off-label and in unproven prospective controlled trials. Third, match the drug to the patient's disease burden and individual profile. Microscopic colitis can be devastating on a patient's quality of life, but generally it does not carry the structural complications of severe Crohn's disease. That means careful selection, shared decision-making, and the lowest effective maintenance dose will help to decrease the chances of having an untoward adverse outcome.
That's really helpful. I think that's an excellent place to end. These cases remind us that refractory microscopic colitis remains an area with a significant therapeutic gap. JAK inhibition is not ready to replace established therapy, but the responses reported here, including dose de-escalation and resolution of concurrent inflammatory conditions, suggest that this pathway deserves further investigation. Dr. Elving, thank you for joining us and for sharing your perspective. And thank you to everyone listening to ACG Case Reports Journal podcast. We hope you'll join us again for our next case discussion. Be sure to subscribe to ACG Case Reports Journal's Behind the Case on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.